This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, that's just not literature. The myths of fantasy writing.
So this week, I'm just going to go ahead and warn our listeners. Jules and I may get passionate about this.
Yes, I think this is one that's been coming for a long time. Ultimately, we've touched on the subject before. We've touched on it in episodes such as The Slow Death of Literature and The Problem of Susan and Final Fantasy. And really, we're looking at why fantasy of all genres is kind of denigrated to being low entertainment for the weak-minded.
Yeah.
And if you think that's putting it too strongly, you clearly haven't been hanging out in the sort of the fantasy community very much, because it comes up a lot.
Yeah, it really does, yeah. And I feel like Jules has finally snapped.
It was gonna happen. It was gonna happen. A caveat to begin with, we mean not to offend, but to enlighten. That said, I have got no problem with naming real offenders on this one, because this is not a case of somebody choked in an interview once and said something that was a bit off. This is a case of, no, that person continually re-entrenches their opinion with every single interview.
Yeah.
And then backs it up with the way that they present things in their own work, and obviously we'll go into that a little bit later.
Yeah.
Obviously this is my opinion, it's Madeline's opinion as well, and you know, you're obviously entitled to your own opinion. So if we happen to hit something that you really, really like and you think, oh, that's not fair, that's fine, you can tell us that, respectfully, please. By no means do we serve as a template for being arbiters of all taste.
Yeah, absolutely. With that disclaimer put forward, then, let's dive in, shall we? And I think sort of the place to start, the jumping board, really, is the question of what is genre fiction?
Yeah, definitely. Ultimately, I think we have to go from the position of all fiction is literature. That doesn't mean all fiction is literary, because literary is an umbrella term for a particular type of style.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often not even the authors who write literary fiction realise they're writing literary fiction until it gets branded that later.
Yeah.
There's a funny story around that I'll tell you later. Genre fiction, once you've written a book, you have to sell it to the right audience, and it's quite difficult to separate out your audience from the huge audience of readers out there. So booksellers, agents, publishers, libraries even as well, all found it a lot easier if you could say, well, this book fits these genre tropes, these genre categories most clearly, so that is where the book is going to sit on the bookshelf. So that is why we have genres, ultimately, so that readers who are potentially audience members of that book can find the book with relative ease.
Yeah, and we've used this example before, but the whole popularity of Lord of the Rings and Tolkien's work meant that people would come in and say, hey, I want to find more stuff like this. And so just having it very conveniently all on one shelf and publishing things which are, oh, lots of people seem to be really into Tolkien, so let's write stuff which is like Tolkien and we'll just call it fantasy, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. The problem with this, unfortunately, is that it's attracted a certain amount of snobbery. Now, I say this from the position of being aware that at times I fall into intellectual snobbery myself. However, snobbery for an entire genre, or even an entire set of genres, because it doesn't fall under what you personally consider to have literary merit, is borderline insanity, because quite often the people who are saying these things have never even read any of those books. So if you're kind of like, I don't like crime fiction. It's all about murders and mystery. There's nothing else in there. There's barely any plot. It's the same plot recycled over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
I would say anybody who has that opinion has never really read very much crime. And yeah. just like, if you say, well, fantasy's all magic and world building, and there's no real theme, there's no depth, then I would say you haven't actually read any fantasy. And you could apply this to all genres, ultimately.
Yeah, and I think there's also a massive level of hypocrisy that plays into this as well, in that, and I'm going to use fantasy as an example because it's the most obvious punching bag, which is that there is this great level of snobbery regarding fantasy and the fact that it doesn't really contain literary merit. And yet you have things like magic realism, which is really part of fantasy. You know, it's part of the speculative fiction umbrella. And yet you can have literary texts which also have magic realism within them. An example, for instance, people are constantly waxing lyrical about Angela Carter.
Yeah.
Obviously, she's a feminist writer, and she's recreating fairy tales in The Bloody Chamber, for instance. It's a collection of fairy tales. And people kind of really look at that as, oh, you know, this is great literary fiction. It's full of magic. It's absolutely full of magic. You know, there's a story about an actual vampire at one point. You know, there is magic which does literally occur within the story. And the idea is that they say, but that's not, it's not fantasy. It's magic realism. It's magic realism. As if to say that that there's actually a difference, really, between the kind of magic or having any kind of sort of magical things within a book, which are literary fiction and fantasy, but that there is a clear divide, and that it's just about acceptable, or even it should be invited because it adds something to it. And I think there's a real level of hypocrisy to congratulate Carter for her use of these magical elements within the story, and then with the same brush condemn fantasy for using the same tools.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that is one of my biggest bugbears with this sort of snobbery, is the fact that the people who sneer at fantasy and science fiction and other genre fiction too, but mostly fantasy,
mm-hmm.
are also the ones who will praise to the skies things like The Night Circus by Erin Morgenstern because it's got a more literary style. Or they will love the reading group literary style of fiction such as Sarah Perry's Melmoth, which, by the way, has this disturbing wandering Jew mythology attached to it. And is kind of a creepy ghost story, but because it's written in a particular way and examines character motives, it's obviously not fantasy. To me, that's fantasy. Or Sarah Perry's The Essex Serpent, whereby a huge serpent-type creature apparently crawls out of the fens and feeds off sheep.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's lots and lots of them. David Mitchell, not the comedian, David Mitchell, the literary writer, mm-hmm. writes things like Cloud Atlas and The Bone Clocks and The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet. And I love his work. He's one of my favourite authors, and he's clearly a literary writer.
Mm-hmm.
But he borrows from science fiction, he borrows from fantasy, he borrows from historical fiction, he borrows from ghost stories and horror.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes all within the same book, I would like to point out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing is that we also tend to put merit on things which are older as well. And we say, this is literary, this is you know, literary fiction. Because it's older, and we say, look at this writing style and things like that. You know, Frankenstein, for instance, which is science fiction, very yeah. clearly science fiction, as well as being gothic, you know, and all sorts of very, very much speculative fiction. But also just in general, older texts, which we put literary merit on, simply because they are older. We put a lot of literary merit on Shakespeare, for instance. And Don't get me wrong, this is not me saying Shakespeare was a bad writer. Shakespeare is a brilliant writer. I absolutely adore Shakespeare. His use of rhythm, his evocative speeches and imagery, and his look at the fundamentals of humanity are you know, brilliant, absolutely fantastic. He also has a lot of penis jokes. Like 70% of his writing is puns. There's a lot of humour there. There's a lot of magic there. There's a lot of crowd-pleasing stuff there, and references, and all these things. And I think that the fact is that if Shakespeare were writing today in modern tone, people might not think of him as literary.
No, they probably wouldn't, because he'd be writing something that would be quite popular, because more people would read it, but also that included deeper themes and things, which is obviously something we'll get onto in a moment.
Yeah.
So, it is a bugbear, and I think it's not one we're ever going to completely solve, certainly not in this episode, but we are going to let off a bit of steam. And I think the thing that bugs me the most is not so much when people on the outside of the fantasy community criticise us without really understanding what's going on. Not even so much when fans of fantasy start criticising fantasy as a genre and saying, well, I read it, but, you know, I realise I'm only reading sort of the work of hacks, and I'm reading pulp, and I feel kind of cheap reading this, but it's what I like to read. As though they're ashamed of their own reading preferences. That bothers me.
Yeah.
But what really bothers me is when people who write fantasy start criticising the genre and trying to deny it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there is also... It's complicated, because on one level, sometimes you have writers like Neil Gaiman, for instance, who will then begin the debate of, well, what even is genre? And should we start being so funny about genre, so criticising it on both sides, and saying, you know, the moment we start really thinking about genre as this, that, or the other, we start to box ourselves in. But then, yeah, you do have authors as well who vehemently argue that they are not writing fantasy, and there is a kind of a level of shame to it. So I can understand both sides to it, but... what's his name? The Japanese writer.
Kuja Hishiguro?
That's it, yeah. Who, their most recent book involves ogres and fantastical, you know, magic scenes and stuff like that. And it's caused large controversy, because some people are like, hold on a second, this is not literary fiction, this is fantasy. And then people in the fantasy side saying, this is not fantasy, this is literary fiction, and people, you know, arguing, you know, that you're stepping out of your lane, and the author themselves has just turned around and said, I'm just writing the same that I usually write. And because they're so known as a literary fiction writer, everyone's like, oh, so you're just refusing to admit that you're writing fantasy. There's a large level of snobbery there.
Yeah, got to say I agree with you there. And it's like Haruki Murakami as well, who in my opinion has been writing science fiction for quite some time, except it's not the science fiction where everything's set in space and the elements are quite subtle, but here's shifts in the timeline and you know, shifts in potential futures, and you're looking at things like Never Let Me Go, where you've got a dystopian future and everybody creates a sort of double, so they've got a backup organ supply.
Yeah,
I mean, that's me boiling down a very complicated plot into one sentence, and I haven't really done it justice, but trust me, it's there. So, yeah, and maybe he doesn't even really think of himself as a fantasy or science fiction author, and that's fine, and he just borrows things. But it would be incredibly poor taste if that either of those particular authors, or any of the others, were to suddenly turn round and, you know, look down upon genre fiction that's a bit more honest about its origins.
Yeah,
I think
absolutely. Yeah, and people do that.
They really do. I mean, I see Neil Gaiman's point. I find Neil Gaiman quite literary in his style, but he very definitely writes science fiction, fantasy, horror, and various other things.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just weird. Sometimes he just writes weird fiction. That's just Neil Gaiman. But he's a really nice bloke. He reads science fiction and fantasy and everything else. And he's always willing to, you know, talk up an author that he personally enjoyed. Mm. I've never met him. A friend of mine has. And apparently he is a genuinely nice person who's accessible and respectful and all the rest of it. It's kind of everything you kind of want in a fantasy author, particularly since he's sort of now heading into being the godfather of fantasy kind of thing, whether he means to or not.
Yeah.
And then you have people who are not like that at all. I don't really want to have a pop at J.K. Rowling, but I do want to mention this because this is odd, in my opinion. And I'm not going to mention some of the more controversial stuff that's come out recently because I don't feel qualified to address that other than to say it makes me very sad.
Yeah.
But this in particular came out quite some time ago, and I'm quoting her here. I don't especially like fantasy. It didn't occur to me that Harry Potter was fantasy until I'd finished writing it. And then she later goes on to say that she's never read Lord of the Rings all the way through. She DNF'd it. Well, fair enough, quite a lot of people do. She's never read all the C.S. Lewis books, which her books get compared to quite a bit, apparently. Mm-hmm. And it seems like she just doesn't generally like fantasy or whatever. Anyway, now, it seems to me very, very strange that you can get into an argument online with Terry Pratchett about whether you write fantasy or not, obviously before Terry Pratchett died.
Mm-hmm.
he's not doing the Wizard and Glass thing.
No.
But about whether you write fantasy or not. And Terry Pratchett's kind of like, you've got wizards and whizzing and, you know, magical sweets and wands and a magical world. So, yeah, you're writing fantasy. I mean, it doesn't just have to be fantasy. It can be all sorts of other things as well. But it's fantasy. And I kind of see his point. And, you know, wouldn't you read Harry Potter and think, yeah, that's fantasy?
Yeah, I never realised that was up for debate.
No, neither did I. It's certainly always been marketed as fantasy. And I think you'd have a hard time marketing it as anything else.
Yeah.
So that was very peculiar. And it just seems to be an opinion she's sort of entrenched more and more as she's gone on. Even though, you know, she's sort of screenwriting the Fantastic Beasts stories. And she must actually like what she's doing as well, because I couldn't see doing it with any kind of level of commitment or love if you don't actually like the story.
Yeah.
But she's more into writing her crime fiction. And again, that's fine. Nobody has to stay writing within one genre for their entire life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you think you haven't got much more to say in a particular genre, it's perfectly okay to change genres and take on a pen name or whatever. That's fine. But it seems very weird to deny your origins.
Yes, it does. And I can understand. I think the thing is that children's fiction also has, it still exists in this weird place where the coming of the genre, the coming of the genre was really came about during a time when children's fiction didn't really exist. There were books that were for children in order to educate them and stuff like that. But, you know, that there wasn't really children's fiction. And it was slowly kind of developing. And kind of because of that, I think that, for instance, when you go into a bookshop, you go to the children's section and it's split by age. It's not split by genre or anything like that. It's split by age. And so there's almost this kind of genre doesn't exist almost in children's fiction, which is complete rubbish because it does. So I can kind of understand her sort of turning around and being like, no, I was just writing a children's book, because a lot of children's stories do contain elements of fantasy. And in fact, most children's stories contain elements of fantasy, even if there's no magic in them, because they involve children who have to go and do extraordinary things, which is fantastical even of itself, you know.
Yeah.
So I can kind of understand her saying, oh, it never really occurred to me that I was actually writing something that was fantasy. What feels strange to me is that even if that never occurred to her, the moment it was, you know, pointed out, there should have not really been any kind of wriggle room for her to deny it. You know? Or for her to kind of just turn around and be like, but it's not really fantasy, because, well, yes, it is. It is fantasy.
Well, yeah, I mean, in all fairness, I didn't realise I was writing a mystery story as well as a ghost story.
Yeah.
And it was only when someone said, yeah, it's a great mystery, and I'm like, oh my God, I've written a mystery novel. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like, oh, the light comes on, you know. It was like, yeah, okay, I like writing mysteries. I must like mystery stories. And then I thought about all the books I'd read. I'm like, oh my God, I've always loved mystery stories, but I'd never thought of myself as a mystery reader.
Yeah.
But that's completely different to I don't like fantasy.
Yeah. And I do also think that, yeah, but there's this huge level of snobbery that comes with fantasy. And I think also the problem is that that also connects to the level of snobbery that comes with children's fiction. Because children's fiction does tend to be fantasy on some level, we tend to think of it as not really having any literary value. And I think the two things are connected, despite the fact that I would argue it's completely to the contrary, really.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Okay, let's go on to the absolute worst offender. It's... I'm putting on the ranty pants now, so if you want to duck out for about 10 minutes, that's absolutely fine. Although I will attempt to be entertaining while I'm ranting. It's no secret on Dissecting Dragons that I don't think very much of Terry Goodkind. I don't think I've been particularly scathing, but I'm also not really in a pulling my punches type of frame of mind with him either. I think he's probably one of the worst offenders when it comes to absolutely denigrating the genre he actually writes in and that made him a big name author.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a couple of statements to prove that. These first ones come from basically a fantasy con type panel he was doing where he was asked specific questions. I'm trying very hard not to quote him out of context because I think it's important that he remains in context and incriminates himself. Put it this way, he needs no help from me. I don't need to twist things to make this look bad. So I'm going to read a couple of these things and, you know, your honest reaction, Madeline, would be most appreciated.
Okay.
So on being asked what made him want to write fantasy, Terry Goodkind replied with, "First of all, I don't write fantasy. I write stories that have important human themes. They have elements of romance, history, adventure, mystery, and philosophy. Most fantasies are one-dimensional. It's either about magic or world-building. I don't do either."
Oh, you mother! Oh! Oh! Most fantasy... What? I'm genuinely flabbergasted.
It gets worse. There's a bit more.
Okay, keep going.
Okay. "In most fantasy, magic is a mystical element. In my books, fantasy is a metaphysical reality that behaves according to its own laws of identity." Which is a fluff answer that means absolutely nothing.
No, it's just, but I do it smartly. Everyone else is just do-do-do-do-do, hocus pocus.
But I think the bit that got me most is this final bit.
Okay.
"Because most fantasy is about world building and magic, a lot of it is plotless and has no story. My primary interest is in telling stories that are fun to read and make people think. That puts my books in a genre all their own. So I guess readers who are interested in story rather than world building and details of magic would have a good time reading my books." I've written a note here to say, no, they wouldn't, Terry.
You prick. I've got to ask, who hurt you, Terry? Who hurt you? Which book did you pick up which scarred you so badly? Like, what were you reading?
Honestly, I think if you read The Wizard's First Rule, the question is not who hurt you, but who didn't hurt you in the way you wanted them to. Because that book is... that book is 98% ripped off from Lord of the Rings and The Wheel of Time and a few other things.
Right.
As in, whole characters and story arcs seem to be transposed and wedged into his... narrow frame.
Right.
They're stripped of meaning and theme, and then the characters are basically used as mouthpieces for Terry to issue his own views on politics. And it is some of the most misogynistic and disturbing writing I've ever read. Plus, one fifth of that book. You know how I'm a bit of a bear for structure, but you know, if something goes in an interesting direction and decides to split the structure, I'm willing to give a bit of leeway. One fifth of the book is about Richard being sexually tortured by women who are specially trained to be dominatrix torturers. I'm trying to explain it to someone who's never read the book, but it's just like...
I'm going to need you to repeat that, because I'm sorry, like, that, none of that computed. What?
Okay, so you start off with the wizard's first rule with Richard, who believes he is someone he's not, but he turns out to be Richard Ruttle. Sorry guys, spoiler alert, but I actually don't recommend this book, so I'm going to spoil the fuck out of it.
Mm-hmm.
He turns out to be Richard Ruttle, who is, and therefore the son of this powerful totalitarian magical emperor type person.
Right.
Who is just across the border. Richard has been raised in secret so that he will not be found.
Mm-hmm.
And then a magical sword finds its way into his hand. Does this sound familiar at all, story-wise?
Yes.
Magical item, etc., etc. And this leads to him going on a quest to activate the Sword of Truth, which is what the series is about.
Mm-hmm.
The border between the realm where he's hidden and the other realm sort of fails. He goes off on this quest, etc. And it has the sort of usual tropes, you know, boy handed a sword and a destiny, goes off to find himself, etc., etc., etc. There's a lot of cutting with the sword, apparently, to give it a taste of blood. Which seems weird. Honestly, I think cutting your arm with your own sword before you go into battle is a really stupid thing to do.
Yes, that does sound like not the best idea someone could have.
And it turns out, as the plot goes on, it transpires that Richard does actually have some magic as well. He is a born wizard. He's a war wizard, and they're very rare, and you can't teach them how to use their magic. By which Terry Goodkind neatly sidesteps the whole sort of, yes, but you must learn to use your magic type thing.
Right.
He managed to wedge in the trope by where the love interest turns up. Literally, she's the only female character that turns up until the weird bondage chick turns mm-hmm. up.
Right.
She turns up, but they can't have sex or anything because, you know, it would be really bad for him because of plot reasons, etc. So there's the whole purity virginity thing. Obviously, she hasn't been able to have sex with anybody else because she'd do something terrible to them with her power if she did.
Right.
I think we can all agree that that's a bad trope.
Mm-hmm.
So it does that as well. And obviously, spoiler alert, at the end he gets to have the girl anyway because love. But obviously she can't ever be with anybody else except him.
Right. Yeah, no, obviously.
Yes. Because he loves her, but because nobody else would or ever could, etc., etc., she'd end up destroying their mind during coitus, apparently.
Oh, right. Okay.
As you do. So that's already pretty weird. I would already say this is a book written by someone who has written a self-insert character who is annoyingly like the 80s cartoon He-Man, who lectures you at the end of the cartoon. And right. It's always right because he's the main character. And yeah, that's pretty bad. And I think that says quite a lot about Terry Goodkind already. I know we're not supposed to judge people by their fiction, and you probably shouldn't judge me by mine because I'm nowhere near that nice. But... honestly, you really shouldn't. Don't assume I'm like that, because I'm really not. But in this case, this is kind of like, you've written about your own personal fantasies, and then you've kind of gone, I think I'm going to confront some of my darker shit, and midway through the book, Richard gets abducted by a woman who has been trained from a childhood to be able to capture magicians and use their magic against them.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point is, they spend a fifth of the book then torturing him to break him.
Right.
To just break him down. And we're not talking thumbscrews and that. He's tortured with magic and magical artifacts and things. And the thing that's finally used to break him is this dominatrix who is dressed in red leather. Forces him to have sex with her and call her mistress and things like that. And I'm like, again, we're on to like BDSM torture. This feels like it's your fantasy, Terry Goodkind. It's incredibly awkward.
or it's the thing he fears the most.
Well, possibly, yeah. Good point. So, all in all, he's not... All his talk here about, I don't do magic or world building, it's like, no, you're right, you don't. You've stolen it from somewhere else, for a start.
Hmm.
The rest of it, the self-aggrandizing, you have transcended the genre shit, is kind of like, I can't believe you're saying that. Because you write very, very mediocre books that if someone wasn't very experienced with fantasy, they might quite enjoy. And they'll certainly enjoy them probably when they're younger and they're not questioning as much, but they'll read them as adults, as I did. And then go, what the fuck did I just read? And by the way, that plot seemed very, very familiar. So
I think the thing is, and I've not read any of his books, so I can't make judgments based on off of that. I think my issue from what I've understood so far is that there's nothing inherently wrong with these kinds of stories, there's nothing wrong if you happen to be the kind of person who enjoys those books and have actually really gotten something out of them. And I also think it's a little bit unfair to make any judgments about a person regarding particularly their first book or something like that, because, you know, one hopes that we grow. And again, I've not read them, Jules has, so Jules is, you're obviously able to make a much more knowledgeable conclusion from what you've read. But the thing that really annoys me about this is that there should be a level of snobbery against something else which you have been influenced by. And he has been influenced by it, because even if he's not doing the same things that some other fantasy authors are, such as heavy world building, you're still using a lot of the tropes and motifs from these particular stories whilst shitting on the source material. And that really, really annoys me, because this material dates back to the beginning of all of humanity, these kinds of stories. You can't pretend like you've transcended something which... I mean, just even the whole idea that fantasy is all very, very description heavy with no real moving plot. Yeah, there might be a few books about that, but that's only a tiny blip in an incredibly long history of fantastical stories.
Yeah, I completely agree. Unfortunately, there isn't very much that Terry Goodkind will not take a shit on. So, for example, his fans, one fan asked him why, when he used so many other traditional fantasy tropes, he didn't include different races. I'm paraphrasing on this one, but, you know, why didn't use different races like orcs, elves, etc., etc., etc.?
Yeah.
Terry Goodkind came back with a very high-handed reply, which basically amounted to, along the lines of, clearly you're not intelligent enough to read my books. I'm writing about real important human characters, not about cultural bullshit.
Wow, so edgy.
And it's a case of, ooh, that's not a great thing to say as well, particularly when, yeah. So that's already bad. There was another thing he said to another fan, I can't remember exactly what it was, but there's, you know, if you really want to make your eyes bleed, there's a Terry Goodkind Ask Me Anything on Reddit.
Right.
And you can go through it and you can see how he talks to the people who buy his books. And it's kind of, I'm looking at it thinking, why would you ever talk to somebody who did that? I'm not going to say that everyone who buys my books would like me as a person, and I'm certainly not going to say I'm going to like all the strangers I don't know, because mm-hmm. that's just not how we all work. But courtesy's kind of a thing.
Sorry, I'm just laughing because you barely even like the people you do know.
I'm not quite that bad, thank you. No, the people I like, I really like. I'm a bit introverted and don't tend to get to know very many people. I'm always willing to be polite and I'm always willing to talk to fans, actually.
You are.
so this is just kind of a what planet were you on? And then we have this fabulous quote as well, which I think you're going to love.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So asking, you know, what he feels he brings to the fantasy genre. Again, obviously he doesn't like to be called a fantasy author, remember that.
Mm-hmm.
What I have done with my work has irrevocably changed the face of fantasy. In so doing, I've revised the standards. I have not only injected thought into a tired, empty genre, but more importantly, I've transcended it, showing what more it can be, and in so doing, spread my readership to completely new groups who don't like and won't read typical fantasy. Agents and editors are screaming for more books like mine. I'm pretty sure they are screaming, but not for the reason you think they are.
That is an incredible amount of arrogance.
Yeah. I mean, I'm all for, you know, being confident in your own work. And there are times when I think, I wish I could be ballsy enough to say, yeah, my books are good.
Hmm.
Or, my books are good. You should read them. You should try them. If you don't like them, meh. I would like a sort of J. Christoph level of, okay, this person's given me a 1-star review. I'm going to turn it into a brilliant advert for my new series.
Yeah.
But I'm not that person. So I'm just going to accept that I write what I like. But this level of, oh, so, you know, I am literally the second coming is disturbing and somewhat delusional.
It's also, I particularly dislike the idea that he has somehow saved fantasy readers.
Whilst at the same time not reading fantasy.
Yeah, it's
or
like,
writing
oh,
fantasy.
Yeah, but these people who come, these fantasy readers who come to my work, I've opened their eyes to something new. I've brought them into other genres and stuff, and I'm like, really? Have you?
It's like, if you want to make the argument that people who don't read fantasy liked your fantasy books, then yeah, I'll probably buy that because they don't know any better.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, but there's also that there just seems to be this attitude that he seems to think that somehow he is the one who, you know, these fantasy readers who only read fantasy, he's brought them enlightenment.
Yeah.
You know, he's brought them out of the darkness. And that, it's so condescending. That's so incredibly condescending. And I can't even begin to say how condescending that is to other fantasy authors.
Yeah, agreed. And, you know, he's kind of a shitty writer. As in, you read it and he's got a strong voice, definitely. But the more you read it, the more you're like, this is contrived, the characters are quite shallow. I've seen all this before. And I can honestly understand. I genuinely don't think the first book, Wizard's First Rule, which I think was published back in either the early 90s, when there was less competition for big epic fantasy type novels. Because even sort of 20, 30 years ago, there was less competition. So I don't think it would get published now. I think the reason his books continue to get published is because he's already built a following over the last 20, 30 years with books that would not get published now. He hasn't really changed. He hasn't grown as a writer, in my opinion. From what I mean, to be honest, I gave up on The Sword of Truth about 8 books in.
Yeah.
Because that was my limit. That was my bullshit limit. I was like, nope, not doing this to myself anymore. So, yeah, not a great writer, kind of arrogant already, and denigrates the genre, which has made him his money. And then it takes a pop at his own fans, particularly if they dare to refer to his writing as fantasy, which is bad and unprofessional. And the final nail in the coffin, where I was still kind of like, okay, he's kind of a douche nozzle, but maybe I will just see how the series ends, because I'm a completist.
Mm-hmm.
The final thing that sort of said to me, no, I'm not going to do that, he put up a picture of the cover of, at the time, his latest book, Shroud of Eternity,
yeah,
on Facebook, and said, Shroud of Eternity is a great book. Like, let's not overstate things here, Terry. With a terrible cover. Look, seriously, have you ever seen a worse cover than this? Let's have some fun. And then invited people to make witty comments about how terrible the cover was. And he said he would pick the 10 best ones and they would all win a signed copy of the hardback.
Yes, I remember that incident. That is just...
Yeah. The artist, who, by the way, is absolutely fantastic. I mean, seriously, check out the guy's website. It's the beautiful artwork he does. He does all Mark Lawrence's American covers.
Yeah.
He's amazing. Came back with a very polite, "It was nice working with you, Terry." I obviously produced the cover to the specifications I was given, because that's what cover artists tend to do.
Yeah.
And good kind just came back with, "We have never worked together. I've never even spoken to you. This is any conversation we've ever had. Anything you got specification wise came from my publishers. It had nothing to do with me."
Mm-hmm.
I think there's been enough pot stirring for one day. As if this poor artist, who is not a heavy hitter like Terry Goodkind and mm-hmm. has to make his money from something creative as well,
yeah,
was somehow stirring things by saying, "By the way, dude, you're being really unprofessional."
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, you're not only a crap writer and weird politically, you're also kind of a shitty human being and a bully, and I don't want to support you anymore.
Yeah, that's... I think also that probably the whole thing with the cover as well is basically, I mean, what I remember of the cover, and I'm just bringing up the picture as well, because I remember seeing it and going, this looks like a very typical fantasy cover.
Yeah.
And I think probably that's why he really disliked it.
In that possibly. He was
like, oh, it just makes it look like it's a fantasy book. And it's like, well, has it occurred to you that might be because you've written a fantasy book?
It gets marketed as fantasy, as all your other books in that tired series get marketed as fantasy.
Yeah. Yeah, I've just got the cover now. I mean, the artist is brilliant.
Yeah.
It's good work of art, but it looks like the cover of a fantasy book. That's all. That's the only issue that I could see with it, that he really would have any reason to get upset about.
Apparently he got upset because there were high heel shoes.
That's just incredibly.
And I'm like, that. If that was even true, that is the least of your
okay,
problems.
Okay, yeah,
with that
so
book.
I can understand getting a little bit annoyed about that. Like, being like, oh, of course, it's very typical, but...
But that is how he writes them, that's the thing. That's how he writes his female characters. Definitely fantasy's most wanted in the negative sense.
Yeah.
As in, for God's sake, please stop supporting Terry Goodkind. Or, you know, challenge it. Because I really genuinely don't see the point in... I don't understand how you can... Okay, you want to tell yourself you don't write fantasy, but guess what? What you've written has drawn a lot of fantasy fans who maybe know what they're talking about. Why would you then turn around and tell mm-hmm. them they're stupid? Which is ultimately what he does, is he condescends to people.
Yeah.
So, yeah, stupendous ego, and is doing absolutely nothing in the whole sort of, you know, fantasy is a lower form of literature kind of argument.
Yeah. And it's so disrespectful. It's so incredibly disrespectful, not just to the readers, but to the other authors of the genre. And to also... single-handedly say that you are the one who's responsible for changing the face of the fantasy genre. Look, there is some bad fantasy out there. Of course there is. There's some bad everything out there, yeah, which has just been written to appease a desire for people who wanted more of the same, you know. But I would also like to point out that I think that the rise of things like fan fiction has actually meant that the literary world has actually tightened up, because it used to be, oh god, I've just read Lord of the Rings, I really want something, I want more of that, so I'm just going to have to find a book which is relatively similar.
Yeah.
So suddenly they could produce a lot of things, good or bad, you know, with their own merit or not, which people would buy. Whereas now it's like, oh god, I've just read Lord of the Rings, I really want more of that. Well, look at that, there's 10,000... fan fictions that I can go ahead and read, which means that I think that the things which are being published, and of course that's not all all true for everything, but I think the things which are being published now, there's more emphasis on there being merit to each individual story, you know?
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
That's just rude. I'm really, like, I genuinely feel upset now. That's just so incredibly rude.
It's like, so now you know why when Terry Goodkind comes up in conversation, my ears, smoke starts pouring out of them. The thing, it's like, I don't think there's any other author who makes me quite as angry, even the ones who are like really, really ridiculously abusive on Twitter, and I'm just kind of like, okay, you're a small person with a small life, I can just like let that go. But sexist, misogynist, horrible, racist person who just does this shit constantly and then tells me what I read is stupid even though he's writing it.
Yeah, it's just rude.
Okay, let's have a look at some of the reasons that fantasy is considered so inferior.
Yeah. Okay. Why don't you get the ball rolling?
Yeah. We've touched on this briefly already. And it's that fantasy is not considered academically viable.
Yeah.
Which is stupid, because anything you can study is academically viable. So if more fantasy was studied in universities, then it would be academically viable, and really somebody probably should study some fantasy, you know, comparatively, say Lord of the Rings, Wheel of Time, and a few other things, more recent ones, and look at what they're saying about social commentary in the times they are written, and then you would find, guess what, these are actually academic texts.
Yeah, but this is the amazing thing, and again I touched on this earlier, which is that I teach at a university. We study fantasy texts all the time. At this semester alone, this year alone, I have been teaching Frankenstein, Dracula, Angela Carter's Fairy Tales, The Woman in Black, and I did a whole module all about myths and mythology, in which we were drawing on things like, you know, from Stephen Fry and Neil Gaiman and all of these. Like, these are all fantasy texts.
Yeah.
But it's just the idea is like, oh, but those are older stories, so it's acceptable. Like, no, shut up. It doesn't matter when it was written. If it's a good text, it's a good text.
Yeah, exactly. If this is a book that's really got something to say, then it is worth studying.
Mm.
Definitely, in my opinion. Particularly if you've got a huge comparative, or, you know, a huge inclusive world. Like, so you've got Discworld, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be very surprised if someone hadn't done a PhD on that. But, you know, to bring it more into the classroom, that's something that's really worth looking at, because the social commentary that goes on in Discworld is incredibly rich and detailed and nuanced.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's funny and it's fantasy, it's, you know, it's silly, I think, is the consideration.
Yeah. It's just so unfair, to be honest. It's so incredibly unfair.
It is ridiculous.
It also, I often, at universities, there will be a fantasy module. Or usually it's a fantasy sci-fi module they're put together. Because automatically it's the same thing, apparently. Mm. And one thing I frequently see across the board is whenever there's a fantasy module, the texts that they study are old fantasy and older sci-fi. And they never look at any modern fantasy or modern sci-fi. So that even if it's semi-modern, it's the idea that, no, but this is the old, this is the good stuff. This is the good stuff. Like age... It's like a wine, apparently, that the older it is, the better it will be. And I kind of look at a lot of the old stuff and just be like, I find this so turgid and boring. When you can actually look at modern fantasy and modern sci-fi, which is dealing with very modern issues. Why dismiss things like Star Trek when Star Trek is onto itself? Yes, it's got its problems, but... It's all about social commentary.
Yeah, absolutely. I think another issue is that fantasy is considered childish and is therefore only for children. And obviously you touched on that earlier with the Harry Potter issue and the fact that she didn't consider it a fantasy novel because she was writing for children, which I think is very, very on the money.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's, you know, children's fiction, anything goes and you can include fantasy elements and there's no real distinction, which I think does a disservice to a lot of fantasy, of a lot of children's authors, to say that, to lump them all together like that, because some people write incredibly rich, nuanced, contemporary middle grade fiction, and some people write incredibly nuanced and rich fantasy middle grade fiction, and there is a difference.
Yeah, and I'm just going to make a small point here, which is relevant, which is that I wrote for adults for a very, very long time. And writing for children has been one of the hardest things I have ever done.
It's incredibly challenging.
Incredibly difficult.
Because what children want out of their books and what you then have to condense in a way that's, you know, that is sensical in sort of 65,000 words instead of 120,000, you know, what they want out of their books is incredibly detailed, and children know what they want to read as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they're less willing to forgive mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing is that the commentaries as well, like there's almost a social obligation that people ignore, which is that we do put a lot of commentary where we look at a lot of life lessons and issues and deal with certain themes. Like death, for instance. Death is a hugely common theme that you get in middle grade books, because usually around that age, that's the first time kids are coming up, you know, facing death for the first time in some form or another, through a pet, a grandparent, you know, or just becoming conscious of it, as it were. Yeah. And you've got these huge themes, and you've got to package them in a way which is digestible, but is also helping children cope with these things. And fantasy goes hand in hand with that. And that's not a new thing. That's something we've always done. We've always used fantasy as metaphor to deal with real stresses, life, death, adolescence. You know, it happens in fairy tales, it happens in mythology. It's all about growing up and developing. And the idea that that is just therefore for kids is ludicrous. The fact that we use those stories frequently for kids is just because at that age they're becoming conscious of the things that we are then dealing with for the rest of our lives, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree with that. Right, other ones. Fantasy cannot be taken seriously because it includes magic and other magical type tropes, and therefore it doesn't tackle big important themes.
Yeah. And as we've said, it's like why write a metaphor when you could just write about the real thing? Well, I'll tell you why.
it all goes back to the days when we were living in caves and we were kind of wired for story at that point. People remember story, they don't remember warnings in the same way.
Yeah, absolutely.
At its simplest. The other thing is, would you rather read something you enjoy or would you rather read something that's an instruction manual?
Yeah. And the other thing is that I think people fail to understand that there is that through story there is catharsis.
Yeah. Absolutely.
We don't get the same level of catharsis by reading a newspaper as we do by reading a book, you know? And so if you hear the true story of a person who's suffered horrifically, you tend not to be happy about it. You tend to actually feel quite affected by it. Whereas if you read a fantastical story where someone has suffered horrifically, you can actually, first of all, separate from it, whilst also dealing with it. And if it's also something that you yourself have also dealt with on some level, you can go through that healing journey with them without being traumatised, re-traumatised, from the first get-go. That telling stories is also about healing and come to terms with your own, with what's happening in your own mind. And people don't actually aren't necessarily that good at doing that if you just tell them to do it. Like, right, we're going to sit down, we're going to make you relive all of your trauma, and then we're going to try and take it step by step. Whereas if there's an element of fantasy, it just happens in the background. Am I making any sense?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And, you know, it's obviously complete bollock to say that fantasy doesn't connect with deep themes. I would argue that anyone who says that has never actually really read very much fantasy.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Or clearly hasn't understood it.
Yeah, that is one way you can say, well, okay, I think that's gone over your head and maybe fantasy's not the genre for you. But at the same time, you cannot argue that because of your experience that nobody else is getting that sort of engagement out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's totally fine to turn around and be like, actually, I just don't enjoy fantasy. Fair enough, you don't have to. But that doesn't mean that just because you don't enjoy it, it has no merit. I don't really enjoy science sci-fi, but I don't turn around and say that it's without merit.
No, absolutely. Okay, this is one of the most ridiculous arguments I've heard about fantasy, and it's making a resurgence. This is an argument about fantasy that sort of cropped up in the late 70s. There was less fantasy for me as a child because of it, because it wasn't being published for this very reason. And that is that fantasy is damaging to your mm-hmm. mental health.
Yeah.
This is something that Diana Wynne Jones had difficulty with. She had written fantasy books and she ended up writing them and not being able to get them published for a decade because people were saying, oh yeah, but you can't give that to children because if you give them fantasy, they won't be able to tell the difference between fantasy and reality.
Yeah, it's so many levels of absurd. It's actually hilarious. Because once again, all you have to do is look back at history and see that very clearly that's not the case.
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's a ridiculous thing to say that fantasy will contribute to mental illness. It's now, as I said, having a resurgence, and it's having a resurgence under the idea that, okay, that young adult fantasy is a knockoff fantasy and it's weak for light-minded people.
Yeah. Which I can't even begin to dissect how insulting and ludicrous that is.
Agreed. That has to be a particular bugbear for both of us. And obviously we write for adults yeah. as well, but it's a ridiculous mm-hmm. thing to say, yes, there's bad young adult fantasy, and yes, there's bad young adult fiction. There's also very, very good, excellent young adult fantasy and fiction. And if you're worried that people are moving away from traditional fantasy into young adult, maybe that has more to do with what fantasy was not including until fairly recently.
Yeah, absolutely. It just annoys me, to be honest. And yeah. I think what happens is that you people get a few cases and say, well, look at this person who, you know, that happened to, and say, okay, but that's incredibly sad and very unfortunate, but that's not the universal experience. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's the same argument by saying, you know, it's video games that make people go and shoot up their schools in America. And it's like, well, no, actually, it's the easy access to guns and the fact that certain students aren't probably given the support they need.
Yeah, the easy access to guns and the poor healthcare potentially may have something to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there is an argument to be said that, you know, certain aspects of fiction might normalise violence, they might normalise things like rape, and there is definitely a conversation to be had there. But to say that fantasy encourages a state of mind whereby you cannot engage with reality is ludicrous, it is ridiculous.
Yeah, it really is. And also to then say that that's a reason to stop us having it, that's a reason against yeah. it, it's just... To be honest, you can't stop it, because it is a fundamental of our storytelling. It always has been. And to try and get rid of that would be to try and completely erase large parts of our, of every culture, because fantasy is present in every culture, one way or another.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it would just be saying you cannot have story. You may as well just say that ultimately.
Yeah.
You cannot have fiction, you cannot have story.
Yeah.
So that is obviously stupid. And I particularly hate the repackaging of it as, okay, well, you know, fantasy might be borderline respectable in some areas if literary authors deign to use it, but then you've got young adult fantasy, which is for the weak and light-minded, and it is a knockoff fantasy.
Yeah.
And I also... That's stupid, because if you find that your usual... Sorry.
No.
If you find that your usual fantasy author... you find that your usual fantasy audience is turning to young adult fantasy, that's because it is offering something that fantasy traditional fantasy is currently not offering or has not been offering as much of. And as we've said before, young adult tends to engage with things like diversity and sexuality and representation. And a lot of traditional fantasy was a bit slow to take that up, and now that is changing.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also the other thing, which is that I think a large part of it is just that weird desire people have to just shit on things that teenage girls like. You know?
Yeah, there is very definitely something in there. You know, if it's written for girls, particularly teenage girls, then it must be mediocre and inferior by nature.
Yeah, or just because...
Again, something that really bugs me.
Yeah, or even if it's designed for things that teenage girls will like. So talking about romance, you know, therefore it must be inferior. Because it does look at romance? Well, I'm sorry to say, you know, lots of stuff does. That doesn't mean it doesn't also look at some other important things as well. It would be like saying just because Jane Austen happens to have romantic, you know, subplots within her stories, she isn't also addressing some other very, very important stuff as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, this is again, it's an eye of the reader thing, and a lot of the people who make these criticisms haven't actually read any of the books. That's another thing that really annoys me.
Yeah. It's just incredibly unfair, to be honest. It just really upsets me and makes me very sad. And again, that's not to say that we're saying all people should like YA books. There's a lot of YA books now that I can't really read because I just feel like this is not relatable to me anymore. That's fine. That doesn't mean they don't have merit. But there's also a lot of adult books which, you know, a lot of YA books I would rather read than adult books because actually I find that YA does something that these adult books are still too afraid to do or to address.
Yeah. And you're right, and I find there are a lot of young adult books where I'm like, I would have really engaged with that 10 years ago, 20 years ago, but now that's not really ticking my boxes. And that's clearly, that's just a thing, you know?
Yeah.
You get older and different things become important to you in your reading material, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
And not every book is going to transcend every part of the, you know, the generation gap. Unfortunately, that's just the nature of things.
Yeah. And that's also... okay. Like, that's all right. It doesn't need to transcend everything in order to have merit.
Yeah. It obviously doesn't make it worthless. So, I mean, these are the main points of why people will sneer at fantasy, and usually, but obviously not always, in the case of people like Terry Goodkind,
mm-hmm.
these are people who haven't really read or understood or engaged with fantasy. And it's fine that they haven't. It's absolutely fine, as long as they're not saying, well, it doesn't have any merit. I think there needs to be a bigger conversation about saying what fantasy does do. And when people start sneering at it, don't be afraid to stand up and say, well, actually, that's bollocks. You know, your opinion is your opinion, but at the same time, what you're saying is kind of bollocks because... don't be ashamed to read what you read. You know, honestly, if you want to stand up and say that Mills and Boone has literary merit, then perhaps it does. Perhaps it does for you. And
mm-hmm.
it doesn't do anything for me, but that doesn't mean that it's not an important piece of literature for you.
Yeah.
We need to stop being snobby about these things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, let's look at a few let's look at a few fantasy examples that actually really do bring home, and this is a very small selection of fantasy examples that really do talk about important stuff, hopefully sort of largely in the now, or at least in the last 100 years. That are fantasy novels or films or whatever.
Go ahead, you start. You get the ball rolling.
Okay. Obvious example, but I think it's one that does need to be made. No matter what your problems with it, and no matter even if you find it stodgy to read now, and a lot of people do, and that's fine, The Lord of the Rings is one of the best examinations and meditations on post-World War Europe that's ever been written. So it's actually an important war document almost in its own right, and it has a huge amount of academic merit. It's multi-layered in terms of both story, mythology, linguistics, understanding of human nature, and yes, it has parts in it that I don't actually particularly enjoy very much. As in, whenever they get to Tom Bombadil's house, I actually kind of feel like quitting, but I know that it gets good beyond that. I don't see the point of that part of the story, but that was the point. He was writing a collection of myths and legends, potentially, that could belong to Britain. But yeah, this is written by somebody who was actually in the First World War, and then when the Second World War came around, the Germans, the Nazis rather, kind of wanted to take over Lord of the Rings, he kind of stuck one finger up at the German publishing house that wanted to do it. So yes, you can have problems with Tolkien, and yes, some of it's very dated now. The selection of roles for female characters in there unfortunately followed the medieval poetry strain.
Yeah.
And that's not great for a lot of reasons. So yeah, it will have some endemic sort of racism and things like that involved as well because of when it was written. But it's still a really important academic text in its own right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think something that's often forgotten is that the hobbits actually end up suffering from shell shock. Like, I distinctly remember, and I think it's Pippin goes looking for Merry and finds him on the battleground, and Merry's like, "I'm dead. I've died." And Pippin's like, "No, you're not dead." And it's just quite, and Merry's just completely doesn't understand what's going on. He's in just absolute shock. And I just thought, that was brilliant. It was brilliant the way that was portrayed. It was this true reality of the horror of battle, really, and the after effects of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm gonna mention Harry Potter because and we're just gonna ignore J.K. Rowling because at this point it's just difficult to talk about her without going down a rabbit hole. But Harry Potter itself as a series did deal with a lot of really important issues for today. You know, not least with things like abuse, poverty, bullying. It obviously has a great sense of the found family trope. But also, in particular, one thing that she really, really did deal with, and in a very good way, was the idea of the media and government control of the media and censorship. And that was portrayed incredibly well. The idea that when basically the wizard Nazis took over, all of the newspapers and stuff like that, it was just all controlled. And up until that point, it had also been controlled. And racism was still rife, even at the highest level. And there was corruption, and there was willful ignorance and things like that. She really portrayed something very real and very dangerous in a very accurate way.
Yeah, people can poke at it all they like, and there's definitely things that perhaps wouldn't be written in the same way today, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But ultimately, this tells a story of the childhood experience.
Yeah.
And the seemingly paradoxical actions of adults and the gradual journey from being a young child and being quite idealistic to getting to the verge of adulthood and realizing it's not simple. Nothing is simple choices.
Yeah.
And nobody comes out of things being the same as they were before. So yeah. I think it does that really well as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. Yeah.
Okay, another one that I would mention. I've got quite a selection, actually, but I'm not going to go into all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to go down a slightly darker route, the Broken Empire trilogy by Mark Lawrence. I'd always recommend his work anyway. The Broken Empire trilogy features his, I don't want to say worst character, his worst character in terms of, this is not a good guy, okay? This is someone who starts off kind of as an antagonist in his own story.
Mm-hmm.
So the protagonist is kind of a villain. He's motivated by largely selfish motives. And what's interesting about this character's journey is the fact that he goes from being a 14-year-old boy who sees things in a very particular way and not a very nice way either,
mm-hmm.
a way that he's learned through violence and abuse, etc., and towards the end becomes almost an unwitting hero. What that entire trilogy says to me is that it's our choices that ultimately make us, and you can be a bad person all the way up to the very end almost, and that doesn't make you a good guy when you make the right choice at the very end, but it does kind of mean that there is some form of redemption for everyone, and that we should be even looking at some of the worst aspects of human nature as things that can be guided in a positive direction. I don't know, it's complicated. There are lots of complicated feelings about it, and it's an incredibly entertaining and gripping trilogy. And it's probably the most grimdark of all his trilogies, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But what Mark Lawrence does very well in all his books is this examination of themes and the deep understanding of character motivation. So it's an incredible example of the absolute fallacy of saying that fantasy doesn't engage with deep themes or characters.
Yeah, I think you're right. The thing is, right now I know we're running out of time, so I'm just trying to choose one of so many fantasy books I've read which have actually dealt with things in incredibly important and realistic ways. I think I probably will mention. I think I'll probably mention Six of Crows, and I'll mention Six of Crows because of the way that disability and trauma are presented. And yeah. I particularly like this because it was the first time, really, apart from with the Percy Jackson series, but it was the first time I'd encountered a book, a fantasy book, which dealt with dyslexia, extreme dyslexia, and the reality of what dyslexia feels and looks like, and you know, the way that you're sort of made to feel. Again, it was done with Percy Jackson, which I'd read before that, but this was, you know, the second time, and the only time I'd ever seen it in YA book. But also, I thought that it was very important because Kaz Brekker is traumatized by the events that occurred to him when he was a very young child. And that trauma is not beautiful in any form at all. It is debilitating in every way, to the point of being physically debilitating, to the point that it makes him an even more unpleasant person. And that doesn't excuse his behaviour. And I thought that there was something very important about the fact that he is called out on it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's another one of those ones where it's your choices that make you, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yeah, you are stained by the things that happen to you, but you're also responsible for the things you then do afterwards, and that is done extremely well.
Yeah. I've seen lots and lots of stuff which have got characters who are dealing with trauma. And again, I'll also mention... sorry, guys, I'm so predictable, but The Gentleman Bastard Sequence, book two, without giving any spoilers, book two begins with Locke Lamora basically suicidal, and he's just drinking himself to death.
Yeah.
And it is it looks at the genuine after effect of horrifying trauma and experience, and the very very ugly side of not being able to deal with that properly. Like there is nothing romantic or nice about Locke's depression at the beginning of book two. He hasn't showered. He's given up. He's drinking. He's dirty. He's drinking. He's dirty. He's sick. And he's being a real asshole about it as well. And I just like the fact that it was the first time that I'd really seen mental health issues being presented as not something which was kind of almost a bit chic or beautiful, which happens a lot in YA. It was like, he was so tragically beautiful. And more along the lines of, no, this is a person who hasn't showered in a while. They stink. Their breath stinks. They are not keeping it together. They are not in a good place. And it needs to be addressed.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, I'll mention one more. And it's... Oh, God, which one do I mention off my list? let's go for Seth Dickinson's The Traitor Barrow Cormorant, which is a geopolitical fantasy. It's quite a heavy hitter. I mean, anyone who says fantasy doesn't have themes and depth should really totally read this book, because I needed to think. I really needed to think as I went through this. This is not a light read. It asks a lot of you. It expects you to keep up and it expects you to remember shit too. But this is an amazingly rewarding book if you can follow it. And it's kind of... It looks at all the intricacies of colonialism and why it's not a simple... Mm-hmm. It's not a simple question when you're invaded to just say... We want to put things back to the way they were, because once that's happened, things are not going to be the way they were. And also looking at invading the system from within and trying to change it, and how power corrupts, or rather it attracts the bright and the intelligent and the people who think they can make a difference. And they turn out often to be corruptible. Mm-hmm. Not even easily corruptible, but yeah. they'll make a choice because you... When you play chess, basically, you will sacrifice pieces in order to win the game. But after a certain point, you've made so many sacrifices, yeah. you've kind of got this sunk cost fallacy going on, whereby winning the game becomes an end mm-hmm. in and of itself. So this is kind of looking at Barrow Cormorant, the main character. Her character arc is literally the birth of how someone goes from being an idealistic, very intelligent child to being a villain. And it's utterly yeah. compelling and very convincing. So let that be my final offering. I have an entire list. Perhaps I'll blog about it and people can come for my book recommendations.
Definitely.
It would be a long blog post.
So yeah. but yeah, so basically, guys, I think the natural conclusion that we can draw from all of this is that anyone who tells you that fantasy has no literary merit should be removed from the equation. And I'm not that sorry. I realise that's
that sounded like you were taking out a hit on them.
That sounded vaguely like me saying, right, yeah. and then the murders began. No,
they're talking about their ass, basically.
This is when I get arrested. Yeah, they're talking rubbish, and you should just ignore them. If you don't have the energy to argue with them, just ignore them, because it's just complete bollocks. It really is.
Absolutely.
And I have no time for it. Oh dear! I'm waiting. I'm waiting for someone to knock on the door. Like, so we heard you've been encouraging your listeners to commit murder.
Oh my God!
No, officer, you can prove nothing.
Fortunately and unfortunately at the same time. Hopefully, we don't have that level of influence just yet.
Not just yet. No, But in future, who knows? Oh, though, before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation. Jules, you have one for
us today. I do. I've just finished the Diviners series. I've talked about it before on previous episodes. It's by Libba Bray. It's a quartet, and I've read the final book, The King of Crows, and everything I've said about the series so far, I'm reinforcing my opinion and doubling down on my recommendation. It is an amazing series, particularly since we've just been talking about fantasy having important things to say. This really does. You know, and it contains so much as well. It's sort of historical. There's obviously romance. There's a strong ghost element all the way through as well. Basically, if you love the Unveiled series, then you're really going to love the Diviners as well. Or vice versa, maybe. You never know. But what it says most of all is that it's, I guess, that history is our haunted house and we live inside it. And until we are willing to confront history in all its ugliness as well as its glory, then we will continually get attacked by our own ghosts. And it's an incredibly intelligent treatise on wrestling with your own identity, I think, and looking at diversity and where you have impinged on somebody else's rights, either knowingly or unknowingly, and, you know, how you are responsible for everything going forward. You know, it's not your fault what happened in the past before you were born, but it is part of your responsibility to ensure things are better on the way forward. The characters are all really, really engaging. Yeah. It's an incredibly diverse book. Four books. You should totally read them. And if you like audiobooks, the audiobooks are narrated by January Lavoie, who is absolutely phenomenal. So cannot recommend them highly enough.
Brilliant. And on that note, we will say thanks very much for listening. Do leave us a comment telling us your thoughts regarding this thorny topic. Do you agree with us or do you disagree with us? And remember, we are looking for some of your favourite quotes or moments from Dissecting Dragons. So even if you can't remember it word for word, let us know, either through a comment, send us a tweet, an email, whatever. Or, you know, find us in the night. just come knocking on the door. We'd love to hear from you. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders. Or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.